Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Welcome to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio. Last week, we addressed one of the hit pieces in the creation journals against the hydroplate theory, but we ran out of time to get to two other hit pieces that I think are going to be really fun to go through. So to do that, I welcome back to the RSR studios, Doug McBurney of the Weekly Worldview. Welcome back, Doug.
Hey, thanks for having me, Fred. It's great to be in God's creation for another Friday. And it's great to be here with you. I can't wait to get to the next hit piece on the pre-Tejas volcanism. And then, Fred, we were going to get to an article. Let me look through. Oh, the dinosaur mummy. We're going to get to some dinosaur DNA as well, right?
Yeah.
I want you to promise that we're going to get to that, Fred.
Yeah, we will get to that. I'm looking forward to yet more evidence for dinosaurs not being millions of years old. I mean, we continue to pile on. But you know, Doug, a lot of times piling on is just fun, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So especially because as the pile gets bigger, it gets more impressive and more fun to look at.
Sometimes it's fun to watch a real rout, you know, and that's what we're doing. We're routing the opponent.
And that's it. And you have to jump higher every time. So it keeps us sharp and on our game. And speaking of that, getting to this article from the Journal of Creation, Fred, I found it fascinating because I had never fully comprehended all these different layers that are so well defined. And so take us through the article, how it relates to the hydroplate theory and what's going on with the pre-Tejas volcanism, Fred.
Okay, so this article is from the Journal of Creation just this year, 2022. Journal of Creation number 36, volume 1. And the article is titled Pre-Tejas Volcanism in North America, Challenge to the Hydroplate Theory. So we mentioned Edward Isaacs last week. He's the author of this article. He's had three hit pieces now in the journals against hydroplate theory. So he likes attacking the hydroplate theory. So this latest article, it clearly relies on the work of Dr. Tim Clary, who wrote a book called Carved in Stone. In fact, Doug, I have it right here in my hand. Carved in Stone, Geological Evidence of the Worldwide Flood.
Oh.
So what Clary does, he focuses his work on developing what are called sedimentary mega sequences. And I think he does a really good job of doing that. If I was to rate the book on a scale of 5 stars, I'd give it 4, though, because there's too much in there about catastrophic plate tectonics. Without that, it would be a 5-star book. But he does do a good job with these sedimentary mega sequences. So these sequences are massive groupings of sedimentary layers that were laid down at a specific interval and delineated by erosional boundaries. So that is, they could be recognized by their bounding erosional surfaces and also sudden change in rock type. And so he's been studying this for some time and documenting it in this book, Carved in Stone. And because these mega sequences are not reliant on fossils and their supposed dates, they have become the preferred method for studying the sedimentary deposits of the flood. Now, I will say that other creation scientists have problems with this method, including John Reed. He does a lot of writing for the Creation Research Society, and he's also a PhD geologist. So let's hold that thought for a bit. We'll get back to Reed's criticism of this theory.
Yeah, and he starts off by saying, quote, "This emphasis on volcanism has been extended to most diluvial models with the exception of the hydroplate theory," unquote.
Yeah, so in my opinion, right off the bat, that's wrong, Doug, and we'll see that he's engaging in what I believe is the logical fallacy of begging the question, which is a form of circular reasoning. So as I mentioned earlier, he is relying on the work of Dr. Tim Clary, who is a big-time CPT proponent. I mean, he really pushes CPTs whenever he talks. I've seen him give talks, and his talks are generally really good. And what I like about Dr. Clary is he doesn't just talk about geology. He's also got really good talks on dinosaurs and things like that. So he's not like just a one-trick pony on catastrophic plate tectonics. So we have talked extensively in the past on how catastrophic plate tectonics advocates, they essentially think that the fountains of the Great Deep are primarily magma.
That's right.
You've heard that, right, Doug? That at the fountains of the Great Deep is really the fountains of the Great Magma.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is something AIG pushes, and visually too, because you see visual presentations of magma bursting forth from beneath the surface of the earth. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they believe in pre-flood volcanics. In fact, they believe in pre-flood ocean floors. They thought there were oceans from the beginning. And they believe that these ocean floors are composed of basalt, which is a type of volcanic rock. And it's a condition that supposedly helped CPT get started. When I say CPT for the audience, I mean catastrophic plate tectonics. So it just, you know, saves me from saying that phrase over and over again. So here's the fallacy. Because he assumes volcanism is pre-flood, and at the start of the flood, he believes that's correct, then Brown must be wrong not to account for early volcanism. Well, you know what, Doug? Brown doesn't account for early volcanism because he doesn't agree with the fountains of the Great Magma.
Right, right.
And I believe a lot of Christians listening to this broadcast would not think that the Bible's talking about magma when it says the fountains of the Great Deep. In fact, there's lots of articles by scholars through the decades and centuries, honestly, that believe that there was a subterranean water. And so they interpret that verse as saying there's a lot of water beneath the earth's surface. And you can go back over 100 years and read commentaries on this. So I'm baffled how this paper can actually make it through peer review right out of the gate, at least have him correct this paragraph because it's the logical fallacy. And I just wonder if maybe they don't have enough people reviewing these things. I hate to be critical of the journals. They have good stuff in there, but also, you know, as a subscriber, I also think they need to do a better job with their peer review and just not let certain rhetoric get through that's masquerading as science. And that's right out of the gate. That's what's happening with this. And we'll get into it in a little bit more detail.
Yeah, it's true. He goes on to fairly accurately, by the way, he goes on in the paper to accurately explain the hydroplate theory compression event and the mechanics associated with it, such as tidal pumping, supercritical water. He does a good job. He also mentions hydroplates liquefaction as the primary mechanism for laying down the strata. And he goes on, I want to quote from the paper. Fred Isaac says the following, quote, "Volcanics should be overrepresented in the most recent rocks. After all, he proposes that volcanism began only during the waning phases of the Genesis flood after most strata had already been produced. Brown states that the first major volcanic outpourings on North America were the Columbia River basalts following the formation of the Rocky Mountains during the compression event at the close of the continental drift phase. This implies volcanism initiated in North America in the Tejas mega sequence, the highest of the seven primary unconformity bounded series of strata. Therefore, pre-Tejas volcanism should be small to non-existent in North America."
Okay, so he's talking about these mega sequences, and to some degree, he does accurately describe the hydroplate theories. You know, he mentions the compression event.
PT proposes that volcanism began only during the waning phases of the Genesis flood after most strata had already been produced. Brown states that the first major volcanic outpourings on North America were the Columbia River basalts following the formation of the Rocky Mountains during the compression event at the close of the continental drift phase. This implies volcanism initiated in North America in the Tejas mega sequence, the highest of the seven primary unconformity bounded series of strata. Therefore, pre-Tejas volcanism should be small to non-existent in North America.
Okay, so he's talking about these mega sequences, and to some degree, he does accurately describe the hydroplate theories. You know, he mentions the compression event. That's when the plates that are sliding away from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge come crashing, meet resistance and crash and start, and all of a sudden you get mountains just pushing up pretty rapidly, and that's the compression event. So this particular part of his article, to me, has two major problems. And this really, again, it seems to come from just such a deep-seated opposition that I feel like sometimes I'm debating with evolutionists and just the sheer number of logical fallacies they employ.
Oh, that's kind of rough, Fred, comparing them to evolutionists. That's brutal.
Sometimes that's what happens, and I'm sorry to be so blunt. But first, he claims that volcanics should only be present in the most recent rocks according to the hydroplate theory. And he also assumes that megasequences are pristine and unyielding. So again, he engages in the aforementioned type of circular reasoning. So let me take a moment to elaborate on each. Dr. Brown believes that volcanism began with the sliding of the plates that culminated with the compression event. Nowhere that I could find in his book does he say that volcanics should be, quote, non-existent in Clary's pre-Tejas megasequences, and this is a sedimentary sequences just before this last one, the Tejas, and I'll get into that a bit in a second. Also, I could not find anywhere where Dr. Brown claims that the first volcanism was the Columbia River basalts, and Isaac's citation, he doesn't support that in his claim, so I'm not sure where he got that.
Yeah, he kind of made that up. If you're as familiar as I am with the theory, I'm no expert, but this compression event would have produced volcanism for some period of time before the formation of the Columbia River basalts. Am I right on that?
Well, so, you know, again, I've got with me Dr. Clary's book, and the mega sequence that he has just before the Tejas, so this would be the one laid down right before this last one, and that's called the Zuni mega sequence. Now, I wonder if that's Zuni or Zuni.
Fred, is it Zuni or Zuni? Everyone who lives in Denver for the last 150 years has had that argument about that street in Denver. And
so
I
true.
I think it's 50-50, and you're allowed to say it however it most easily rolls off your tongue.
Okay. I'll stick with Zuni mega sequence. So
okay. So that would be, so that's the sequence laid down just before Tejas.
Exactly. So apparently, volcanism, when you take catastrophic plate tectonics, continental drift, or all of its runaway subduction, so that phase, for it to start there, is okay, but it's not okay when the hydroplates begin to slide. So I don't quite get that. Clary mentions drift possibly starting as early as day 100 for CPT and up to day 150. So anywhere between 100 and 150 is when catastrophic plates, they start drifting. Hydroplate theory postulates the slide at day 150. So, Doug, I'm really struggling to see I don't see a ton of difference in the time frame here.
Right. That's what I was thinking, was that there was a certain period of weeks and months that the compression event slid along and could have created enough heat. So, yeah, where is the disagreement?
Yeah, so, well, the amazing thing is when you look at the amount of volcanics associated with these last two sedimentary sequences, they actually fit nicely with the hydroplate theory if you remove these logical fallacies. So on the show summary page, I'll plan to scan some of the pages of the charts of volcanics for the last two mega sequences and to show kind of what I'm talking about when I say that there's actually not a lot of volcanics in that sequence before the Tejas. So let me try to quickly go through the six major mega sequences to give the audience an idea of what each of these are about. And so the first three have very little volcanic material associated with them. The first mega sequence is called the Sauk, S-A-U-K. That it would have been laid down early in the flood. On page 196 of Dr. Clary's book, you can see a tiny spot of red in North Alaska, and in the northern part of Alaska, where at most 1% of volcanic material is listed. And Doug, maybe this is that near that same tiny area of Alaska where they don't want us to drill for oil or else we'll ruin the whole world.
Yeah, that must be it. Yeah.
So then the next layer up is the Tippecanoe. There is 2% volcanic material in this tiny area near Alaska again, and it's right near the Ring of Fire. And then there's a small blotch near Maine. The third layer up, you've got the Kaskaskia mega sequence that has a whopping 3% volcanic material. So we can see these lower layers have very little volcanic material. Clary actually makes absolutely no mention of volcanic activity during this stage of the flood for catastrophic plate tectonics. So basically, these three opening mega sequences, they were laid down before continental drifts, before catastrophic plate tectonics and hydroplate theory. And here we are still in the 40 days of the rain phase.
Oh, okay. Okay, so it at this point, it fits with the hydroplate theory, and it doesn't necessarily disagree with their ideas about catastrophic plate tectonics.
Yeah, at this point, the score is even. They both are in total compliance with this idea. So the fourth sequence is the Absarica mega sequence. And according to Clary, this may coincide with the start of runaway subduction. Again, I say it may coincide with it. And its volcanic material is just 5%. And again, it centers in Alaska on the Ring of Fire, and it's near the Columbian Plateau. The Columbian Plateau. Then the next is the Zunai mega sequence. This is the one right before the last one, the Tejas. And this is when plates are clearly sliding and things are getting hot.
Okay, so now you've got some hot, like magma and volcanoes, right?
Yeah, things are really heating up. But again, you know, poor Walt Brown and the hydroplate theory, we're not allowed to have volcanic activity during this part of the flood, according to Isaac's, what I have to honestly say is clearly flawed logic.
So hydroplate theory gets put into timeout during the Zunai sequence. We're not allowed.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah.
Well, so how much volcanic material is actually reported in this sequence?
Yeah, so we can see that as we go up each sequence, there's really tiny amounts. So you get to the Zunai sequence. Hey, you know, I just said Zunai, so maybe I'm interchangeable on that. I can be Zuni or Zunai.
I wasn't gonna bring that up, Fred, but almost everyone I've talked to in Denver since this argument has started, we've all said it both ways, and we have to catch ourselves.
Yeah. So as it turns out, Doug, the Zunai mega sequence has 7% volcanic material, and some of it appears along the Ring of Fire and a bunch on the east shore of South America. And again, I'm hoping to scan the pages, Clary, where he's documented these percentages. And then finally, the last and uppermost mega sequence that we've mentioned is the Tejas, and it has a much higher 18% volcanic material. But this is the only place Walt is allowed to deposit his volcanic rock. It has to be the Tejas.
Now, here's something interesting. Dr. Lawrence Schloss, the secular science guy who came up with mega sequences, he said this, quote, "Sequences should be considered as rock units, assemblages of formations and groups. They are simply the strata which are included between objective, recognizable horizons and are without specific time significance since their limits do not coincide with timelines and may include rocks of different ages in various areas," unquote.
Wow. So let's say that again. This is Lawrence Schloss. He's the guy who came up with mega sequences. He was the originator of this concept of how you're going to look at sedimentary deposits around the globe. And he says these mega sequences may include, and I will say with emphasis, rocks of different ages in various areas.
Right.
So now we have, as young Earth creationists, we don't agree with the dates they give rocks. But Clary, in his book, when defending seafloor spreading, says that we can trust their relative ages. So wait a minute. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander? By the way, Doug, I always wondered where that came from. You know, we did a show on do dogs go to heaven? Do gooses go to heaven? I wonder.
Anyway. Well, it's good for the dog is good for the goose. I suppose if dogs do goose, I have to look that up, Fred. What's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Should we do four shows on do gooses go to heaven?
Well, we'll get the crack Real Science Radio research team working on the goose gander question. But let's return to the mega sequences for now.
Okay. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, there's plenty of creation geologists, and this includes John Reed, and he's been writing articles. He's a geologist for the Creation Research Society, And he published a lot of articles in the CRSQ Journal. I used to be their webmaster, and I'd always get, you know, all the articles that I'd have to post on the website. So Dr. Reed said this: since depositional environments would have been determined in part by water depth and geologic energy, topographic variation would have created differences in geological conditions based on floodwater position, not time. And that's one of his articles where he's like, this mega sequence idea, we can't just strictly adhere to mega sequences as being totally pristine. And this is the gospel truth of, you know, this strata all around the world. And that's a big objection that I have with Isaac's paper. He's acting like this is the be-all, end-all truth, and you can't have different ages of rocks in different areas that are actually from easily potentially different sequences. Both Dr. Reed and the secular scientist says they caution us on this. So Dr. Reed he's basically saying that strict adherence to megasequences will definitely misidentify sediments here and there that have different geologic conditions. Perhaps like that volcanic material they found in that tiny part of North Alaska, you know, near where Al Gore doesn't want us to drill.
Yeah, right. And where the hydroplate theory is not allowed to lay down even an infinitesimal amount.
Correct.
Of volcanic material. Anyway, his conclusion further exposes his circular reasoning, by the way, and his biased rhetoric. He writes, quote, "Though volcanism is central to most modern tectonic and geodynamic models, hydroplate theory stands alone, relying on supercritical water as the driving force of the Genesis flood. This forces HPT to focus on recent volcanism, despite the distribution of modern volcanic activity being one of its claimed strengths. HPT fails to explain the extensive volcanic record of the pre-Cenozoic." So this is kind of like when evolutionists claim creationists have to focus on intelligent design because we can't explain the sequence of fossils that they say supports evolution. Is that what this is like?
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, that's actually a good analogy, kind of like a redirect. We actually challenge Isaac's assumption of pre-flood volcanism. Again, they think the ocean floor basalt is pre-flood, and it's a requirement of catastrophic plate tectonics. And then he attempts to pigeonhole hydroplate theory into only being allowed to have volcanic material in there, and I emphasize their last mega sequence. I mean, Doug, do we really know for certain that all of the mega sequence data is wholly reliable, 100%? You know, just as we don't agree to get to your analogy, we don't agree with fossil progression showing evolution. You know, they claim that it shows that, but we disagree. And we don't agree with Isaac's and Dr. Cleary's assumption of pre-flood volcanism and the fountains of the great magma. We don't agree with the fountains of the great magma. So,
right.
Again, this is a sort of fallacy of begging the question, circular reasoning. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't ring as a very compelling argument at all against the hydroplate theory.
Right, right. And we're allowed to disagree with their assumptions because we can, by just acknowledging that these mega sequences aren't pristine, that there's going to be a little bit here and a little bit there, but they don't, it's like they don't want to do that. Anyway, I noticed that Isaacs gives acknowledgement to quite a few reviewers. In my view, I think there's a good chance that one of the reviewers of his paper might be Dr. Cleary.
I think that's pretty likely. And I mean, I it's tough to say this, but I think that should concern us because in my view, this isn't good scholarship. If you're going to try to defend your theory, this isn't the way to go about it. And it's just in one of those unfortunate moments where I just think this stuff needs to be called out. I can't see justification for the paper passing peer review, but it is what it is. And don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that Cleary is wrong to pursue mega sequence documentation. I think that's all really useful work, actually. And I know Bob was very encouraging to Dr. Cleary to do this. And it has proven to you to be a useful tool in understanding the Great Flood, miles deep of sediment all around the globe.
Right.
But what is happening really here is such a huge hostility against the hydroplate theory that it's allowing misuse of these tools and I'm sure unintentional misrepresentation to the public about the hydroplate theory. there's so much more to it. I mean, Isaacs has a decent understanding of hydroplate theory, but a driving force isn't just super critical water. There's also gravity plays a huge role in the hydroplate theory, you know, with the tidal pumping and whatnot.
Right, right.
So, and you know, Doug, I know that he wraps this paper up in the same way he does all his hit pieces. So, Doug, let me get to like a few bullet points to take away from our coverage of this hit piece article. So Isaacs wrongly claims the following. He assumes that the mega-sequence approach is essentially ironclad. This is disputed by other creation geologists such as John Reed and by secular geologists, the guy who even came up with it. So then his second fallacy is, basically, he says that hydroplate theory is wrong to question pre-flood or early flood volcanism because pre-flood or early flood volcanism is right. So he assumes pre-flood volcanism is right, so hydroplate theory, you know, is wrong to question it when we say, hey, we don't agree with pre-flood or early flood volcanism. We don't agree with the fountains of great magma. Right. But he says hydroplate theory is wrong because pre-flood volcanism is right. That's just not good logic.
That's a little maddening.
Yes. And then a next bullet point, even if we assume the mega-sequence approach is solid, Isaac self-imposes the Tejas timeline on the hydroplate theory's compression event, despite really pretty close similar timelines with CPT's runaway subduction that is allowed to start a sequence or two earlier. If Dr. Cleary says that volcanic activity spikes during catastrophic plate tectonics runaway subduction in the later mega sequences, by the way, is it that unreasonable not to allow the hydroplate theory's volcanic activity to start when its plates begin their slide? You know,
that seems to be possible. It should be open on both ends there.
Exactly. It's not that unreasonable. I mean, at this point, the Earth is going through a lot of turmoil, and you've got the Atlantic is buckling up and getting the conditions right for these plates to slide. And at the same time, the Pacific, it's subducting in, it's collapsing in to compensate that isostatic rebound. And so already you're getting a lot of fracturing and just a lot of heating up and bad stuff happening in the Pacific. I wouldn't want to have been living in the Pacific continental crust at that time. That would not have been good. But there's a lot of tectonic activity actually going on there. There's a lot of continental crust breaking up. And so why is it not possible for some volcanics to be going on there? But hydroplate theory isn't allowed that. And if it isn't allowed that, then somehow it refutes all of the evidence that we have for the hydroplate theory and all the confirmed predictions. To me, that it doesn't hold water, Doug, and it doesn't hold magma.
You know, he basically ignores the overall volcanic evidence that supports hydroplate theory.
Mm-hmm.
The problem CPT has with magma and crossover depth, he just pretty much ignores all that and just physics in general. And hence, this is really why CPT relies so heavily on miracles, the numerous validated predictions of hydroplate theory. On the other hand, I mean, I can give examples. CPT requires basalt on the ocean floor before the flood, right?
Yep.
Baumgartner needs it for his model. So when Walt Brown predicted that we would find continental crust in the Pacific beneath the basalt that HPT says was formed during the flood, Baumgartner said this in 2012. Here's what he said. Regarding HPT's claim that a layer of buoyant granitic crust currently lies beneath the Pacific basin, such continental crust is readily distinguished from mantle rock by modern seismic techniques, yet there is an unmistakable absence of any thick layer of granitic crust in the Pacific basin.
That's 2012. And something just occurred to me in this quote, Doug, that's going to play in the paper I'm going to write for the ICC on modeling. So he said modern seismic techniques did not detect this granitic crust in the Pacific basin. So these modern seismic techniques, some of them, I mean, they have a lot of good techniques that they use. I'm not going to dispute that. But nevertheless, it's modeling. And these models definitely get things wrong, and they clearly got things wrong here. So Baumgartner, ironically, is relying on modeling data to make this claim back in 2012. But oops, something big happened that Bob and I were just so thrilled to report on it in 2017 when they actually discovered the eighth continent of the world. Zealandia. You can go to our show, right. rstar.org/Zealandia, and they've got an entire continent. So let me repeat that. A continent. That means continental crust buried in the Pacific. And, you know, you've got secular scientist and plate tectonics critic Christian Smoot. He worked for the U.S. Naval Oceanographic Office. He actually helped map the Pacific floor. He was once a plate tectonics advocate, and then after he mapped the floor, he's like, oh, man, they got everything wrong. He said this in 2018 about the Pacific crust. He said this based on his findings. Much of the Pacific Ocean floor is underlain by continental crust. Now, this guy isn't a hydroplate theory guy, but maybe he would be if we can, you know, get a hold of him and say, hey, dude, Walt Brown predicted this, you know?
Right.
So he said that so much so that the Russians have developed an idea they call oceanization, whereby the entire Earth was all continental and the floors in the ocean basins are being converted to basalt by technothermal, magmatic, and rifting processes. Here's an admission to what we believe was the original Earth was continents with seas.
Right.
We do believe in a sort of Pangaea where you've got continental crust all around the globe. It's all one big continent, but you've got a lot of seas within the continents. Catastrophic plate tectonics people for the creation movement, they think that basically you had this Pangaea and then you had huge oceans all around it. So basically with their global flood, they don't have to add water. They just use the water that was already there, you know, which we don't agree with because they have a serious problem. Where did all the water come from? Well, they think that it was all a bunch of water swashing up and around from oceans that already existed. And I think there's good scriptural case to even argue against that. But anyways, what a big oops. You know, you find Zealandia, an entire continent. So maybe those seismic techniques aren't 100% gospel as he believes they are, and often too many scientists do, to try to support plate tectonics. And that's what I'm hoping that my paper gets into, you know, one of the different types of modeling where they run into problems like this, Doug.
Yeah, the models can make things. What was the old saying? All models are incorrect and some are useful.
Exactly. All models are wrong. Some are useful.
That's it.
I led the team at Micron Corporation up in Longmont. I was the team lead. I think we had 12 engineers on my team, and I led the modeling team for 3 years. Now, I don't think my work was useless, but I'm going to tell you, if anyone asked me, now, do you accurately model the NAND? I would say no, not even close. But we do just enough to allow our engineers to run simulations against it so that they can weed out bugs before we actually get to the actual NAND, you know, NAND that has issues, for example, like quantum tunneling and things like that, that is just too difficult to model. And then just try to imagine trying to model the Earth and all the different material and components and the physics involved. It's light years, exponentially megafold, more complicated. And yet we get theories like catastrophic plate tectonics based off of these models.
Right. And so, Fred, I think one of the reasons when I read your proposal to the ICC, one of the reasons they accepted your proposal is because of your experience using real models in the real world to make real products, puts you in a very unique position to help people understand where they might go wrong with models, where they might go right with models, and how we can actually use models to help us better understand creation. I'm looking forward to seeing that paper. That's going to be exciting.
Yeah, and I'm very grateful to have Rob Bracken join me in co-authoring this article. Rob Bracken has his Bachelor of Science from Stanford University in geophysics. And Rob Bracken, he was a plate tectonics advocate, and then later he became a hydroplate theory advocate, a very strong one, actually. And just over time, you know, the evidence whittled him down to humble himself, you know, honestly, and change his beliefs to support the hydroplate theory. And hey, I got to go with what the data is telling me and not because I have this inclination towards plate tectonics, because that's what I was taught all through college and believed for many parts of his career. He actually recently retired from the USGS, which is the United States Geological Survey, and he's written several papers for them. So I'm looking forward to that. He's on board with helping author this paper. And we'll be definitely be reaching out to, you know, actually, I'm going to try to reach out to more opponents of what we're proposing than proponents, because that's where you can really figure out they're going to work harder to find any errors in your paper. And then we'll do that. We'll make sure we get some good reviews from people who would be normally hostile to our point of view. Because that, again, helps us to weed out things that actually may be blatantly wrong on our side. And then we also have to realize, okay, there'll be biases too, and we have to filter what we think is correct and what isn't. But anyways, I digress. So, Doug, I wanted to get to this
good
last
stuff.
Paper. Yeah.
Actually, Fred would love to get to that paper. And you had promised that we would get to the dinosaur mummy, but I think we're going to run out of time. I'm going to have to come back and join you because we do want to get to the fossil sorting and liquefaction, that paper, the so-called hit piece. We want to get to that. I definitely want to get to the dinosaur mummy. But one thing about the dinosaur mummy, Fred, it's going to be there. It's not going anywhere.
Yeah, it's a mummy.
We'll have a chance to get together again in the not-too-distant future. And I want to remind everyone in the audience that you can always listen to us, or well, at least Fred, and when he lets me come in, I'm always happy to be here on Fridays for Real Science Radio. But on Mondays, you can tune in for the Bob Enyart Live Broadcast Classics. Join us on Tuesday and Wednesday for the Dominic Enyart Show, and of course, Theology Thursday. Every day of the week, there's something here at KGOV, at Real Science Radio. Thank you so much for having me, Fred. I look forward to getting together next time to talk about liquefaction and dinosaur mummies and whatever else comes up.
Yeah, and, you know, I'd like to apologize to the audience. You know, I get emails and, you know, they email us at the show at rsr.org. And, you know, we get a lot of great things that come across the Science Wire, the Science News Wire. And I've been promising, or I've been saying that, I'm not going to say promise, because I can't keep so many promises when I say we're going to get to it on the show, because we're limited to 1.5 hour on air, and then sometimes we run over for people who want to catch the rest on the podcast. But we do have some good stuff on more dinosaur DNA stuff, and the dinosaur mummy. But like Doug said, that mummy can wait. The mummy's been waiting for a long time anyways. We'll talk about the dinosaur mummy. Hopefully next week. I'm pretty sure we can get to it, but you never know because, you know, we're fluid here. We've got news items that pop up. We had that really cool article from the Webb Telescope that continues to prove that God is the God of the Bible and he's the real deal. And, he's a good guy. It's good to be on his side. We're in open arms. We want everybody to come to his side. And he's got open arms big time. But, man, so many people just they don't want to go that route, but we're working to change their minds and change the hearts and minds of people that listen who aren't believers. Anyways, amen. Doug, it's so fun to have you doing this show, and I look forward to getting to the third hit piece next week and dinosaur mummies. So for Doug McBurney, this is Fred Williams of Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain all the way. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real, that's what I'm talking about.